Our next guest has written a book which is part memoir, part historical detective novel, and it's even part workout. Bill Hayes is an American writer and photographer whose other work includes examinations of insomnia, the original Grey's Anatomy, and his six-year relationship with the late author and neurologist Oliver Sacks. In this latest book, Bill charts his research and travels in search of the history of exercise. It's called Sweat, and Bill Hayes is with me from the US. Bill, hello. Welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
Bill, it's clear that physical fitness has been something you've pursued for much of your life, so perhaps it's only fitting that the idea for this book came to you on a particular piece of gym apparatus.
That's right. My favorite cardio machine, the Stairmaster, which is kind of an old school cardio machine. But yeah, it was about 10 years ago. I was in the gym. I climbed atop a Stairmaster, punched in my program. I still remember it was fat burner, 25 minutes, put down my towel, water. And for some reason, I paused and I looked out at the gym floor. All these people, men and women, all different ages, lifting weights, doing chin-ups, sit-ups, Bosu ball, yoga. And I just thought to myself, how did we all end up here? And if I were to trace a line backward in time, where would I land? And I thought for a moment, and then I picked up my towel and water, climbed back down, and I went to the library. And that was really the start of the journey that's ended 10 years later with my book, Sweat.
And in fact, you stumbled upon the fact that even people not associated with exercise, people like Franz Kafka or Marie Curie or Tolstoy, even Einstein, sort of make reference to exercise in their lives.
That's right. Kafka would exercise by wrestling with his neighbor in his building.
I think we all do that, don't we? I mean, that's just part and parcel.
His neighbor would drop by, they would just engage in a quick wrestling match and work up some sweat, and that was that. And I found this in Franz Kafka's diaries. Marie Curie, like Leo Tolstoy, was a bicyclist. Like Einstein, too. There's that famous photo of Einstein on a bike. So with this book, I was digging into cultural sources, historical figures, literary sources, and then my own life. There's sort of my own history of exercise woven into the narrative as well.
And in so blending, what did you discover was the origin of the word exercise?
Well, the word exercise, as we know it in English, comes in the 14th century. But really, the tenets of exercise were articulated in the 5th century BC by Hippocrates, who we now think of as the father of medicine. And Hippocrates wrote two treatises on health, about regimens of health, looking at diet, exercise, and other health matters. But yeah, he very much advocated for exercise. There's a quote where he says, "Eating alone will not keep a man well. He must also take exercise. For food and exercise, while possessing opposite qualities, yet work together to produce health." So he was looking at it from a physician's perspective and really just a kind of intuitive understanding that exercise, that movement, vigorous movement, is good for you. And the same was said or advocated by Plato and Galen, the 2nd century Roman physician. So this was very much a part of ancient Greek and Roman thought. And I trace those origins in the book.
Well, I did say, Bill, that this was part historical detective novel. And I think you've already, you know, described in part what I mean by that. But one of the great intriguing sort of early chapters in the book is devoted to you gaining access to the New York Academy of Medicines and its rare book section. And that yielded up really a treasure trove, including a book you hadn't even asked to look at, but the curator of that particular section of the library knew you needed to see it.
Yeah, I really owe this book to her, Arlene Shaner, a librarian at the New York Academy of Medicine. And I went in just telling her that I was doing research on the history of exercise and wanted to look at a book by Hippocrates and by Galen. And she said, "Well, surely you've heard of Girolamo Mercuriale." And I said, "No, never heard of him." And she said, "Just hold on a moment." And she went away into the back and came back wearing white gloves and holding a pristine first edition of a book called Dell'Arte Gymnastica, first published in 1569. And she handed it over to me. I had to put on, you know, white cotton gloves as well, just to protect the book. And I happened to open it right in the middle. It's a big, thick book on printed on heavy paper. And I opened it to an illustration of two men wrestling. And I swear to God, at that moment, I just thought, what is this book? And I turned the page, and unfortunately, the entire book was written in medieval Latin. So I couldn't read a word except to make out the word exercise in Latin. So I spent some time, a long time, actually tracking down an English translation, because I was just dying to know what Mercuriali had written about exercise. There were a number of illustrations in the book, but I wanted to read the book. So I did finally track down a translation. I even tracked down the translator himself in London and found that Mercuriali had written far more extensively than Hippocrates about every form of exercise known at that time, whether walking, running, wrestling, swimming, boxing, and so on.
I mean, we're talking about someone who, as an Italian physician, was writing 400 plus years ago, and yet aspects of his writing are not dissimilar to the kinds of ways we analyze the benefits of exercise now.
That is exactly right. And that was one of the delights and surprises about getting to know Mercuriali's work. Yeah, he prescribed exercise at a moderate level for all people, men and women. And to say women, it was kind of against a taboo. But he goes through each form of exercise and kind of weighs the pros and cons of each form. And he really dug into Hippocrates, Galen, the ancients, and he's using their writings also to sort of bolster his own thinking as a doctor. He was a personal physician to a cardinal in Rome. So in that position, he had access to the Vatican Library with its treasure trove of antique books and treatises, as well as to the Farnese family private library. So he was in a very unique position to do this research on exercise, the body, health, fitness. And it was his aim, ambitiously, to sort of revive the ancient Greek art of exercise. The book, as I said, it's called Dell'Arte Gymnastica, The Art of Gymnastics, or The Art of Exercise. One big difference between then and now, or even then and the Renaissance, is that gymnastics, the word, as it was known in ancient Greece, meant exercising in the nude.
And we've seen that depicted many times in all forms of ancient Greek art, sculpture. They're always men and they're always naked.
Absolutely. And that's how in athletic competitions, athletes competed and performed in the nude. And one of the more surprising facts I found out was that in antiquity, the sweat of athletes was considered a precious commodity. And there was actually a tool created expressly for the purpose of scraping sweat and oil off the body of athletes and funneled into little pots. And this presumably very funky smelling liquid, sweat and oil of athletes, was presumed to contain the essence of arete, or excellence, the qualities that made them champion athletes. And it was sold in gyms, and there were gymnasiums in virtually every town in antiquity. And it was sold for medicinal purposes.
Isn't that amazing? So it was actually seen as, well, in some ways, it's an athletic commodity, that it's merchandise that you can sell to pass on powers of achievement and exercise and athleticism to another person. For goodness sake, Bill Hayes, don't tell the wellness industry. Otherwise, it's going to take off again. I can just see it. While we're talking about this, Bill, by the way, and I mean, this goes to the very heart of your book called Sweat, A History of Exercise. Sweat, of course, comes up as a byproduct of exercise in many parts of the book. And you make the point that even as far back as Mercuriali, he recognized that sweat was a necessary part of our body's survival and, in fact, our evolution as bipeds.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a kind of misconception among some people today about why we sweat and why one should sweat. The primary reason for sweating evolved was really thermoregulation. It's a way to cool the body down. It's not necessarily a way to rid your body of toxins, though it feels great to be in a sauna or a steam room, and one may think you're just sweating out quote-unquote toxins. The real reason we sweat is thermoregulation. Our bodies get too hot. So I kind of look at the evolutionary reasons behind sweating and also try in the book to kind of dissect the dynamics of human movement. As I myself explore different forms of exercise, from walking and running to swimming, boxing, I did an intensive 6-week boxing boot camp.
And wasn't that a wake-up call, by the way? And you were already fit, and you did 6 weeks of boot camp, and you came out, well, transformed in many ways.
Yeah, and humbled for yes. Sure, humbled. I'd never, you know, been in a fight and knocked someone out, and I sort of had this, I don't know, idea that I'd be really good at it or something. But what I didn't really think about is that when you're in a serious boxing boot camp and you put on your gloves and you're in the ring, there's just as much of a chance that you're going to get hit and knocked out as there are that you're going to actually.
It took 6 weeks of boot camp for you to realize that, Bill?
I think it was like in week two. So what I'm proudest of is that I toughed it out until the very end and then hung up my gloves, and I've never had a desire to do it again. But yeah, there is a whole chapter in the book on my boxing days, but then also yoga and other forms of exercise as well.
And so many intriguing stories I want to get to around that form of exercise, yoga, and also a European influence coming back into India from whence yoga originated. But we'll get to that later. Before we do that, can we just come back to nudity, if we may?
Yes, we may.
You decided to see what mm-hmm. that felt like as a runner.
That's true. Yeah, you know, it's something we just see and accept as fact. Whether you go to a museum and see ancient vases or amphorae with depictions of naked men engaging in sports or athletics. And one day it just sort of hit me, like, how did that work exactly? You know, how does that work?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I decided to test it out. And my late partner, Oliver Sacks, had a home in the country with a very long driveway. It's about a quarter of a mile long, let's say. So there was privacy surrounding the property. And I shucked my clothes and tested out running at various speeds.
Before you go on, you did keep running shoes on, though, unlike perhaps the ancient Greeks.
I did keep running shoes on, and I know that some people advocate barefoot running, but I just didn't think that would work for me. I've had some foot problems in the past. So, yeah, completely buck naked except for my feet. And
there's nothing creepy about that, seeing that running along through the bush, is there?
Well, it was a purely scientific experiment.
I mean, yeah, okay. Come on. All right. So take us through it.
So what I found is that my testicles retracted instantly, as did the scrotum. I'm using anatomical terms here.
Yeah.
And everything contracted. And I was soon very quickly sporting nature's own jockstrap. So I realized it really could work if you're running a race in the Olympics or a marathon or a sprint or even in a boxing ring.
It's really nice to know that we're going into the real depths of historical analysis when it comes to exercise here, Bill.
Hey, I had to look at it from every angle, whether literary, personal, cultural, scientific. I tried to look at exercise from every angle and also make it entertaining for the reader and make it fun.
You're listening to Life Matters. My name's Michael McKenzie, and my guest is Bill Hayes, writer, photographer. His latest book, Sweat, A History of Exercise. Tell us about the role the bicycle played. in not only promoting exercise, but also the emancipation of women.
Yeah, I loved finding that out. You know, we take the bicycle for granted. Here in New York, there are city bikes on, you know, every other corner practically. Everyone has a bike. The actual invention of the bicycle came in the 19th century. It took a lot longer than I would have guessed. It took about 75 years to perfect the bicycle, roughly as we know it today, with a version called a safety bicycle that came in the 1890s. And that was very close to what we see today.
As opposed to the penny farthing, which was a totally non-safety bicycle.
Right. And the very first bicycles didn't have pedals. You just moved yourself forward with your feet. There were wheels, but you just kind of scuffled along. And then wheels were introduced, and they were very different sizes. One was huge, one was small. Finally, they figured out, you know, wheels of equal size, spokes, pedals. And then someone had the brilliant idea to remove the horizontal bar from seat to the handles and call it a lady's bicycle. So women in the Victorian age suddenly had something they could use both for exercise and transportation. One of my very favorite quotes comes from Susan B. Anthony, the great women's rights activist and advocate, who said, and I'm quoting, "The bicycle has done more for the emancipation of women than anything else in the world. It gives women a feeling of freedom and self-reliance. I stand and rejoice every time I see a woman ride by on a wheel. The picture of free, untrammeled womanhood."
And that's so important, isn't it? Because if you're going to have a more inclusive society, you have to have a way for each member of that society, no matter what gender, sexuality, background, culture, to look like they can freely and easily operate within it independently.
Yeah. And there, it's really not until the early 19th century that women and children actually are strongly encouraged to exercise. So there were some real trailblazers during that period. Harriet Beecher Stowe's sister, Catherine Beecher, was really, like, I call her the Jane Fonda of the 19th century, because she wrote a number of books on exercise for women. She traveled the country lecturing, demonstrating. And, I mean, it's in the context of those times. So she advocated and demonstrated and wrote about sort of incorporating exercise into your domestic life as a mother or within the household while doing domestic chores. She recommended using music and even, let's say, while doing housework. It's again, back to that idea of intent. So if you're sweeping the floors or sweeping the outside with the intent that this is getting the body moving, then it puts it in a different category from just chores.
And then a little later on in our history on exercise, along comes this Swedish pioneer pair. Is it Henrik Ling?
Yeah, exactly right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Tell us about him.
Oh, he's fascinating. You could say he's sort of the father of group fitness. When we go to group fitness classes today, whether it's aerobics or anything like that, he developed what he called the Ling technique or Ling system of exercise, which was group fitness. But he was a unique trailblazer both in his exercise techniques, which were sort of choreographed calisthenics, very tightly choreographed, large groups, but also, again, encouraging women. There were separate classes, men and women, dressed alike, repeating these sort of group fitness drills. And one of the most important things that he did was to establish what we might call the first exercise science university, with the idea of training teachers who would export the Ling method to other countries. He was really an advocate for exercise. And sure enough, the Ling method travels by way of teachers to England and to the USA. Catherine Beecher, who I mentioned, had been influenced by Ling.
But there's a dark side to this as well, isn't there? Because that approach to sort of all of population physical fitness, often in large groups, often simultaneously, as a sort of not only a stirring of physical improvement, but also of national pride,
right,
was then taken and corrupted by the Third Reich.
That's exactly right. It's that brings a very haunting quality to it. And not only the Third Reich, but other authoritarian regimes. You think of Mao in China and these gigantic crowds of people doing exercise drills. So that really has its origins in great part to Per Henrik Ling in Stockholm. And Stockholm was one of many cities I visited as I worked on this book over the years.
Yes, I know you've had the great chance to travel the world on this one, Bill, and we all hate you for that. I just wanted you to know. Bill, you write about the export of yoga out of India to the rest of the world at roughly the turn of the 19th century. But then also, fascinating, almost at the same time, India's importation of bodybuilding due to their adoration of one European show pony called Eugen Sandow.
Yeah, he's a fascinating figure. To make a comparison, I think of him as like the Arnold Schwarzenegger of the 19th century. He was a strongman, which was popular at that time, almost like with circuses. But he took it to a much higher level, traveling with the Ziegfeld Follies. He opened gyms under his name. He wrote a number of books with his strongman or bodybuilding regimes. So he kind of brought this picture of the strongman bodybuilder to the masses.
And it was so lucky he did it now, because that coincided, of course, with the development of photography.
That's exactly right. And he happened to be genetically gifted with a beautiful body, and he was unafraid to take everything off and pose nude with a literal fig leaf over his parts. And he would have exhibitions where he would pose and flex parts of his body, and men and women alike could actually feel Sandow's muscles. But of course, for a fee. He was very entrepreneurial, so he charged a fee to feel his muscles.
And he was big in India, where in fact, that kind of marketing and bravado, and also the whole sort of group approach to exercise, started to filter its way back into yoga.
Yeah, it's really a crazy cross-fertilization. He made a tour of India and just attracted huge crowds. They apparently had not seen someone with a body like that, posing, and just a very different aesthetic and attitude about exercise and the body. And there was a kind of cross-fertilization of yoga and bodybuilding. And this comes at a time when there was what's called physical culture sort of exploded globally. And some of this was a reaction to the Industrial Revolution and a fear that people were becoming too sedentary, going, to put it simplistically, like from the farm to the factory, and just not getting enough exercise. So there was this movement called the physical culture movement, which really was virtually throughout the world.
We're jumping around in time here, but you also describe the rise of aerobics in the late 1970s, early 80s, the astonishing, totally astonishing global exercise influence of Jane Fonda, particularly on women through the video and VCR, and also the terrible losses of men you personally exercise with in a San Francisco gym during the height of the AIDS pandemic. And then there was a time, Bill, when, as someone who peppers their own life through the book of trying various forms of physical exercise and describing the incredible influence of your father as a former paratrooper on being physically active, but you stopped for quite some years. Just explain to people why that happened.
Yeah, exercise had been part of my life since I was a boy, all different forms of exercise. And when I fell in love with Oliver Sacks, I really began swimming seriously. He was a great swimmer, both open water swimmer and in pools. And we would swim together two or three times a week at a pool nearby the West Village. But once he died, it was devastating for me. And my interest in exercise kind of died with him in a certain way. And I really hit a wall. I had been working on this book for several years, and my interest in it just kind of withered. And as I worked through my grief and turned to other projects, such as my memoir, Insomniac City, which is a memoir about my life with Oliver and my life in New York City, and really focused on photography, yeah, my interest just kind of went in a different direction. But for health reasons, really, I came back to exercise after about 3 years of being completely away from it.
You had a bit of a wake-up call with a doctor, didn't you?
Yeah, yeah. I'm now 61, but this was, what, 4 years ago. And I was diagnosed with high blood pressure. And it runs in my family, but my doctor, along with prescribing a high blood pressure med, said, you got to step up your cardio. You got to get back in the gym and running or swimming, something. So that was a wake-up call. And it was a great kind of it reignited my interest, not only in exercise, but in this huge amount of research I'd done and accomplished, and half a manuscript I had put aside. So I returned to the book, and it was really during the pandemic. One of the upsides of the pandemic and living alone and being single was I had the time to really dig back into my files and my research and complete this book. So I'm so glad I did. I actually think the time away from the book really benefited the book. And I was able to see what was working, what was not working, how I wanted to weave together these different narratives. The history itself, the story of Mercuriale, retracing his footsteps, and then my own history of exercise.
When you went back to the pool, of course, Bill, this time it was without Oliver Sacks.
Right.
However, you make note in the book that you were often scheduled a time when you were allowed to swim for 30 minutes in this pool. Mm-hmm. And you invariably used to choose lane one, which was Oliver's lane.
Yeah, lane one at the pool at Chelsea Piers has a ladder. And Oliver was older and walked with a cane. So this was the lane that was easiest for him to get into safely. He couldn't crouch down like I can to get into the pool or hop back out of it. He needed to use the ladder. So even if someone else was swimming in that lane, the lifeguards very kindly would sometimes move that person to another lane so Oliver could use lane one. And yeah, that first day back at the pool, September of 2020, I came to my appointment. It did feel almost like a doctor's appointment because you had to make reservations for a lane at the pool. I came to my appointment to swim wearing a mask, was given a plastic bag, told to wear the mask until the moment I get into the water. And the lifeguard said, well, lane one is empty. Lane one is yours. And the moment he said that, I just flashed on Oliver's lane. This is Oliver's lane. And I did feel something of his spirit, I guess, as I swam really happily and gratefully in lane one.
My guest has been American writer and photographer Bill Hayes, author of Sweat, A History of Exercise, published by Bloomsbury. And Bill, thanks so much for joining us on Life Matters.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.